Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us here on this Friday. Please join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talkatsteinershow.org by email. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, log on to our Facebook pages. We are joined here in studio by Stephen Levine, who is a partner in Levine & Curlett, LLC, a former federal prosecutor, and Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. As we look at yesterday's decision in the Goodson case, 410-319-8888, your ideas and opinions, please bring them in. I'll make sure you get to the airwaves quickly. So an analysis quickly, not quickly, but analysis starting with Stephen Levine, just about yesterday's verdict and what you think it says about this trial and why they couldn't convict and where it takes them.
Well, I think Judge Williams explained in his lengthy opinion, if you look at it online, it's about a 39-page typed opinion, and Judge Williams explained in great detail why there was insufficient evidence to convict Officer Goodson on any of the counts. I think what it says is not so much about the trial itself, but about Ms. Mosby's alleged independent investigation. Clearly, there wasn't much of an investigation prior to announcing these charges, and that's really where there's fault in the system. There's no fault in the acquittal. The acquittal was supported by the fact that there were not sufficient facts to convict. The fault really lies with Ms. Mosby raising people's expectations, announcing that these individuals, these officers, had committed a crime when, in fact, we now know that at least two of them committed no crime. Officer Porter is going to possibly stand retrial, and based on Judge Williams' findings, it's extremely likely that the fact finder in that case will determine that he did not commit a crime. It's really not so much that the evidence at trial wasn't sufficient to convict. There was not enough evidence to really bring these charges in the first place. And that's the true shame, because Ms. Mosby raised people's expectations. And even Professor Lawrence Brown here with Morgan State University had the same criticism for Ms. Mosby, indicating that people have been misled by her. And I think there's a lot of truth in what Professor Brown wrote in today's New York Times opinion piece.
I read that piece this morning. I read it actually last night. Doug, your take.
Well, I take a very different position, Mark, and I feel that the evidence supported the bringing of charges. Ms. Mosby should be commended for conducting an independent investigation, because the results of a police investigation, not only in Baltimore but throughout the country, invariably amounts to no charges being filed. Either the prosecutor accepts the police justification for the use of force or for someone dying in police custody, or a grand jury decides to vote against charging crimes behind the closed door of a grand jury room. So it's very rare that we ever see police officers charged with a homicide crime. We have about 1,000 people dying a year from at the hands of police officers. And while most of those situations no doubt were justified, the public never gets to see, hear, or evaluate, because it's done in a very closed process. We've only had 54 officers charged with crimes out of those 10,000 people killed in the U.S. in the past 10 years. 54, and only 4 of them have ever been convicted. So you can't expect that people are going to trust a police investigation where the police are investigating themselves. It simply will, even if it's done well, it's very difficult for community to accept that. So what Ms. Mosby has done is she has followed the evidence. And having been in court every single day except for one day last week, I can tell you that Officer Porter narrowly avoided conviction on 2 of the 4 charges. There was 11-1 in favor of convicting on one charge and 8-3 in favor of convicting on another. You can't say from that account that the charges shouldn't have been brought. And even the Goodson case yesterday, I mean, Mark, in my view, you know, there's always been a real animus, a real attack on the prosecution for bringing these from the very beginning. People were so quick. Some of them were former prosecutors. in the state system who they themselves never brought charges against police. And it also comes from the police union, which is a very powerful union. And they tried to get rid of Ms. Mosby. They tried to move the case out of Baltimore. I'm not surprised by the union president saying this was a malicious prosecution. In my view, Ms. Mosby is doing her job when she speaks for people like Freddie Gray, who usually have no advocates.
Stephen?
So those of us who have prosecuted police officers for misconduct, those of us who are former prosecutors, either state or federal, were quick to criticize Ms. Mosby because Ms. Mosby herself was quick to bring charges without conducting an investigation. To suggest that, well, there have been 1,000 deaths of individuals while in police custody and only 54 police officers have been charged with murder or manslaughter since 2005 is really a meaningless statistic. It doesn't – you have to look at each and every case on its own. And Ms. Mosby didn't do that here. What she did was bring charges against six officers because of the history of police misconduct between police officers in Baltimore and citizens. There's no question that Baltimore City residents have on occasion been subjected to police misconduct. But to hold these six officers responsible for the misconduct of others is shameful. It's outrageous. I don't think anybody wants to see an innocent person put on trial because of the actions of another.
No, and of course, I've been a defense lawyer my whole life, and the last thing I want is to hear exactly what you're saying as a prosecutor, which, frankly, I don't hear as much as I would like to when it's a poor person who's being accused of a crime. But the history here, you know, tells us that when you leave Freddie Gray in the back of a police van, and you leave him there handcuffed in the back, and shackled in the front and unable to protect himself from anything that's going to take place in that van, inches away from hitting his head against the metal sides of the interior. And you're the driver of that van. It's your responsibility to protect and safeguard. And I've spoken to van drivers, retired officers, who have told me that when they take charge of a prisoner, it's like taking a member of your family. It's like protecting that person. And sometimes what we have to do, Mark, is move into the person. We really have to imagine if that person in the back of the van was our son or daughter or someone that we loved, and they're left in that situation, and the driver stays outside the van the entire time, never goes in, never checks on Freddie Gray, never talks to Freddie Gray, never finds out the serious condition that Freddie Gray was in. And then, you know, the court says that the driver was not aware of the injury. Well, if you bury your head in the ground, if you say, I am not going to have anything to do with this, and you have a duty of protection, how then can the public understand why Freddie Gray's death was not attributed to the police failure to take him to a hospital, failure to seatbelt him?
It's too bad the prosecution didn't have you arguing their case. Stephen?
Well, I don't think that argument does anything to further the prosecution's case. There's a significant difference between civil responsibility and criminal responsibility, and Judge Williams made it extremely clear that there was absolutely no intent on the part of Officer Goodson, at least there was no intent that was presented by the prosecution to suggest that Officer Goodson, number one, wanted anything bad to happen to Mr. Gray. Furthermore, there were no outward signs that anything had happened to Mr. Gray prior to that sixth and final stop. So Judge Williams made it extremely clear in his detailed findings of fact that the prosecution simply did not present sufficient evidence. Now, they raised in their opening statement the inflammatory term of art, the rough ride, which was the centerpiece of their case. And then they completely, they being the prosecution, by the end of the trial, completely abandoned that theory because the evidence simply didn't show it. Well, I have to question how a prosecutor can go into trial thinking that the centerpiece of their case is going to be one thing and then completely ignore it by the end of trial. It suggests a lack of preparation, a lack of knowledge about what the case would actually show, and it also shows desperation, that they were just going to throw anything out there and see what sticks. And because of the lack of evidence, this certainly didn't stick.
So before, I'll just respond. Let me just open the phones here, Doug, at first. 410-319-8888 as we talk with two legal minds in our community about what happened in the trial of Officer Goodson. 410-319-8888 is the number. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can also send us an email to talk@steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. Quentin on West Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. I think your show is a vital source of information to the community.
Thank you.
And I really appreciate your integrity here. The judge in this case had a wide parameter, and he chose to reinforce a police state. He had evidence before him to show him that police misconduct. And in view of this verdict, civil verdict being rendered before the criminal trial, that shows that certain powers move to prevent justice from happening. And we constantly have the FOP sounding out someone's in, how should I say it, question their integrity. And it's common sense. We just seen a guy get killed in national TV, and the police are in denial. You know, when does it stop? They're killing black people all over the country. When is there going to be an answer? You know, we got copies of the FBI files showing where the government is complicit with this stuff. So I have no respect for a judicial system that allows the police to persevere when they know they're wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, Quentin. Let's get the call in here. We'll come back to our panelists. 410-319-8888. Mark in Mondawmin, you're on the air.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hi. I'd like to say that I don't think Officer Goodson is innocent, but he is innocent, but I believe that Freddie Gray, he was delivered to him damaged. And you got to see who the arresting officers was, who was involved on his, you know, arrest. Not that I've witnessed any, but I know how cops can be rough on, you know, so-called criminal element and all. And I've had past stories told to me by friends and all how these cops rough you up. They'd be 3-4 times the size of you and sit on your chest, and you'd be only 130 pounds. That's all I got to say. I'm just saying you got to go to the arresting officers. And I don't know, they protect each other and all, but it's terrible, man. I mean, you know, this is when we get swept under the rug, you know, he'd be killed. I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark, for your call. And Doug.
No, and I appreciate the opportunity to be having the conversation with Mr. Levine, because Mr. Levine is a very strong defender of the police having acted without criminal liability in this case. I do think, you know, when we talk about police misconduct, police wrongdoing, to say that something is meaningless when people are dying while in police custody under many different circumstances, I think most people would acknowledge how rare it is that police officers are ever held accountable for their actions. Now, Steve presents himself as a prosecutor who prosecutes police, I assume, for wrongdoing. And I just wonder how many I know that federal prosecutors rarely invoke federal jurisdiction, and even more so, it's extraordinarily infrequent that they will ever prosecute a police officer where an African-American or a Latino was the crime victim. So when we talk about these kinds of situations, it's extremely relevant to look at history, to look at data, to see how difficult it is. And then when we look at this particular case, I don't know if you were in the courtroom or not, Steve, during the opening, during the trial, or whether you're reading the accounts. It sounds like it's the account that's coming from one of the newspapers. But the fact is, the centerpiece of the prosecution case was not the rough ride. It was the rough ride plus the failure to seatbelt, plus the failure to get medical help for Freddie Gray. It was taking no action that would have allowed Freddie Gray to be protected.
Stephen Levine.
There are so many things to respond to with that. The fact that individuals have died in police custody, of course, is not meaningless. The statistic of the number of police officers who were charged is meaningless in this case because each individual case has to be looked at on its own. That's my point. I think it's a very clear point. I am a strong defender in this case of the police officers. In other cases, when I was and I'm no longer a prosecutor, I like to think of myself as a recovering federal prosecutor. There have been instances where I have brought federal charges against law enforcement officers for engaging in misconduct, and I worked with the law enforcement agencies to bring those charges. And that, if I may, Mark, that raises another issue that I think needs to be addressed in this case. I thought, in light of Sheriff Kogan's recent affidavit, that his response that he had very little, if anything, to do with the investigation in this case goes back to my earlier point that this was not, as Ms. Mosby claimed it was, an independent investigation. It certainly wasn't a thorough investigation because although she had claimed to have been working with sheriff's deputies, we now know that is not true. So it makes you question because of Sheriff Kogan's recent filing where he said all he was asked to do was sign a narrative that had been presented to him by the state's attorney, in fact, by these two prosecutors in these cases. So it calls into question the basis for the charges, the lack of a thorough investigation in the first place, which should be concerning to all of us when we're told something by the state's attorney, which turns out not to be true.
I think it's unfair to say that there wasn't a thorough investigation. I think the people who were involved in this prosecution did something that police generally don't do. And they spoke to people. They were able to get the evidence that supported the charge. The judge certainly recognized that in dismissing a motion to for an acquittal at the close of the prosecution case. And I think this whole notion that we have a prosecutor who's going to be able to bring a case to the public for review. When you have a person who died in police custody and you have a van driver who's responsible for protecting him and that van driver is not doing his job, you can say either that the person was aware of the risk of injury because other people have been left paralyzed as a result of not being safeguarded. You could do more. You can bring more evidence to the judge's attention, and that's something that I think the prosecutors will need to do.
So we have to take a break here and get to our next panel coming in. But I mean, it just. But clearly something didn't work because the judge didn't rule in prosecution's favor. The question is why, if that, you know, and from your perspective. And I mean, I think that the first was a hung jury and the last two have been tried by bench and both have been thrown out.
And that's because there was no crime committed. Professor Colbert makes a strong case for a civil case. In fact, there's a civil settlement. So in that respect, justice was done. But that doesn't mean that there was a criminal case here to be had. And going back to the thorough investigation, how can you have a thorough investigation in 11 days, which is what happened here? April 18th, Mr. Gray died, I believe it was April 18th. May 1st, Ms. Mosby announces charges. That's evidence of not a thorough investigation.
And a very quick final thought on this particular issue. We'll come back to this, obviously, but we have another panel coming in.
You know, people love to look at civil responsibility because it involves money. But until we're able to follow through with a criminal prosecution and a successful one and not minimize the criminal liability that's involved, it will never deter police officers or encourage police officers to act as most officers do, which is very professional, very much safeguarding people. I've gotten too many calls, Mark, from police officers who would say, this is certainly not the way that things should have happened in this case. And I think we have to begin to take seriously, and I think this is the first step of taking seriously what happens when police do not follow a commissioner's orders and safeguard people.
So, friend, let me tell that Tom, Renna, CJ, who've been holding on to get on this phone call here, get on the show. We are going to continue this discussion with a panel looking at the social consequences of this, and your voices will be heard in the next 40 minutes or so here in the program. So, do not hang up. We're going to take a short break, but before we do take that short break, I want to thank Stephen Levine once again for coming in, partner in Levine and Curlett, and a former federal prosecutor, Doug Colbert, the University of School of Law, remains with us. Thank you for being here as well. Thank you both.
Thank
this
you.
Really enlightening. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner. We continue this conversation here. CJ and Sam are going to come right to your calls, but we're also, Doug Holbert has remained in the studio. We're now joined by Dominic Stevenson, who's program director of the American Friends Service Committee and co-author of Eddie Conway of Martial Law, The Life and Times of the Baltimore Black Panther, and a leading force behind creating of Tubman House on the corner where Freddie Gray was arrested by Gilmore Holmes. And joins us in the studio once again. Dominic, always good to see you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Dr. Robert Burt's with us. Dr. Robert Burt is author of The Liberatory Thought of Martin Luther King Jr., Critical Essays on the Philosopher King, and he's a professor of philosophy at Bowie State University. Good to have you. Good to see you, Robert. Always good to have you in the studio.
Happy to be with you.
And Doug stays with us. Colbert, that is.
Thank you, Mark.
And you all stay with us at 410-319-8888. So there's a broad question I want to ask the three of you, and then we're going to jump right to the phones and get people into this conversation. Mm. So as I was watching this trial unfold, these trials unfold, one of the things I thought was the problem is the law itself. Mm. The problem is public safety policy. When I think about Freddie Gray, you know, you can argue that Freddie Gray died in police custody. So you can make an argument it wasn't individual officers who murdered him, but it was the policy of policing itself that killed Freddie Gray. That's and incarcerates too many people and injures too many people and abuses too many people. And to me, Dominique, that to me is almost – and I know it's an anathema when I say this. Some people yell at me when I say this, but I'll say it anyway. It's almost more important to wrestle with that than see these officers go to jail to change what killed Freddie Gray. What are your thoughts?
You know, I think it is ultimately, we have to get at that because, to me, once a person's been killed like that by the police, once a person's been killed, there's no justice. The family's dealing with the loss. There's that loss that a community is going to experience. But the reality is, as long as people in the community are still not safe, you know, there's definitely not justice. As long as folks are living in communities where the police are continuing to come in like an occupying force, it's always going to be problematic.
Robert?
Well, I would say I kind of agree with you, but I go a little further in the sense that part of the reason why I partly agree with you because I think the problem isn't with this good or bad cop, but with the system of policing itself.
That's what I'm trying to make.
Yeah. At the same time, the individuals who did
well.
What they did should right. be held responsible for it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I certainly agree with the comments that the guests have already made. We do have a system, and the law has consistently expanded police power to allow them to make arrests for reasons that have very little to do with any objective evidence that they're fighting crime. So you have the Wardlow decision where if a person in a inner city, predominantly black neighborhood runs, that's reasonable suspicion and allows the police to stop them and frisk them. Where if you run in a white community, it's not going to be considered reasonable suspicion. Then we have the case this past week, Mark, where, again, the Supreme Court extended the mm-hmm. power of police to yeah. say police can now come over to any one of us. Now, they're not going to come over to me more likely, that you know, but they can come over to any one of us, and it's going to impact the black and Latino communities the most.
And Native communities.
And hold people, mm-hmm. detain people, keep people in their place while they investigate to see whether you have an open warrant for failing to come to court. Now, mm-hmm. in our city, we got 40,000 people who didn't come to court for lots of good reasons. Namely, they don't always have a lawyer to defend them. They have jobs. They have families. They have school to go to. But if the police now find that you have an open warrant for not paying a fine or anything, you're under arrest, and now the police can do a full search of you.
But you know what? It's like they just codified it. It's as far as I'm concerned, it's always been that way. And blackness has always been under arrest. And that's the real issue. And that's the part that they're not, you know, that's the part that we have to really struggle with, is that, you know, it's about who we are. We've been contained in these communities. We've been over-policed, we've been abused, not just by the police, but by the institutions of government that allow these things to happen.
Including the courts.
So, let me open the phone to you. I really want to know what you all think then about what the not guilty verdicts mean in terms of what the community's response is now and what our response should be as people who are very active in trying to build a different kind of world. What should our response be? Well, let me just ask a question now that I'm up on the phones here. Well, what should our response be? I mean, given that this is the reality, the courts do not seem to be able to, whether it's the courts or whether it's Marilyn Mosby's case or whatever it is, or the law itself. Robert?
Well, in a very real sense, I guess I'm not wholly surprised, because that's the way things usually work. What I think, however, happens to a larger extent is that when the police behave this way, when the courts give them a pass, they can talk about respect for law and order, but they have delegitimized the law. They have destroyed respect for the law. And they're essentially telling us, for all practical purposes, we want you to play by the rules of the game. But the game is designed against you. Now, only a fool will play by the rules of a game that's designed against him. What they're leaving us, in essence, with is little more, quite frankly, than what I've been thinking for a while anyway, the option other than opposition, confrontation, and insurgency. They've left us with almost nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Dominique?
I agree with what Bert has said. But one of the things that I do know, especially from working with folks on the community level, is that we have to work with folks, and we really have to help communities stand up. Some of the answers can come from the people in the community. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily, you know, just for me to give out. I think that we have to reach the folks that are the most vulnerable to the police, and work with them and begin to organize and then determine what our actions are going to be. But certainly at every turn, we've seen this happen. It was no surprise. I was right there near Gilmore Homes yesterday, and with the exception of a brother walking by saying, "Ain't that crazy?" You know, talking about the verdict, I think that the expectation was that it would be not guilty. And we have no faith in the law because it really isn't designed to protect us, and it's not designed to bring us justice. So I think that we're going to have to continue to really organize and work with folks and decide mm-hmm. what the moves are going to be. But certainly it has mm-hmm. to be something bold, and it has to be a serious pushback.
I'm going to come back to the question of the law in just a minute. Let me open the phones first at 410-319-8888. Get some callers in here. Let us go to CJ. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning, CJ.
I just wanted to speak to the whole humanity of the situation. I'm still very upset about the fact that this young man died and had not committed any crime at all. And I think that, for all intents and purposes, normally in a human situation, human beings, regardless of what their roles are, regardless of what the police roles were, who was to do what for what, if someone is in need, it is a normal human response to assist that person, whether you're at a scene of accident or whatever. I mean, just a normal response. And the fact that none of them, neither of the police officers, no matter what their role was, what they were supposed to do, sought to render aid to this young man is very distressful. It speaks to one's basic humanity. As a professional registered nurse, you know, we are taught that if you can't assist this person in your capacity, then you go to the next level. At some point, it was obvious when this man was being dragged that something had taken place to his body. I think that's obvious to anyone without any professional knowledge whatsoever. And the fact that no one, not one of them, even before the riot, even before everything else that has occurred, sought to render aid to this gentleman is very troubling to me. And I think that somehow that whole thing is being overlooked, and I just wanted to draw attention to that and get the opinion of your persons in your studio there. I'm still, as you can hear from my voice, still upset about the whole situation.
No, I hear you, and I understand, CJ.
It really is upsetting to me. And so now, you know, I have to tell our sons who are joggers that you no longer can jog down the street. You now must go to the track. You see what I'm saying?
I do hear what you're saying.
I'm sorry if I'm starting to shake.
No, but it's okay. It's okay, CJ.
I just wanted to draw attention to that fact.
Doug, that's something you've been talking about this on previous shows and here and elsewhere.
And one of the hardest jobs to do for me is to try to convince the white community that what happened to Freddie Gray would be something that they would be outraged, appalled at if it happened to someone in their immediate family. It's very difficult to get the majority white community to see what happened in terms of the humanity of not caring for someone. The law says you have the duty to do it. The commissioner, the police commissioner, orders his police officers to care for prisoners being transported. So I think Dominique's point, though, is so important, that to try to work with existing leadership or people who are giving signs of doing something different. Right now, for instance, to have a prosecutor who's now being under such severe attack, you have the Baltimore Sun writing a very disappointing editorial today calling for her not to pursue charges. I think we have to support our public officials who put themselves to speak for the Freddie Grays. I think we have a police commissioner, for instance, who is willing to support warrant forgiveness. So for those 40,000 people, he wants them to be able to come to the courthouse, get the warrant lifted, and then take responsibility for the cases so they don't have to live 24/7 in fear of being put in jail.
So, I mean, and let me go back to the phone and come back to our other guests at 410-319-8888. Let's go to Nicole in Towson. You're on the air.
Mark, I actually agree with your last guest. I think that Marilyn Mosby actually did a great thing in that she looked at the evidence and that she knew that that you know the police were responsible for this young man's death and that they needed to be prosecuted. Now, I wish she had not pursued the rough ride as her sort of smoking gun, because clearly he was hurt before he even got into the van. And so, you know, the police officers who were the arresting officers, I think, were the ones who should have been first and foremost charged with, you know, some type of, you know, manslaughter or something, because, you know, they actually initiated this entire thing. When he is being dragged to the van, his legs are not moving, you know, he can't even step up to get into the van. So I think that while Caesar Goodson was the driver and that, yes, he should have been charged with something, he actually, I don't think, should have been the smoking gun. I think that the arresting officers were the ones who actually facilitated this entire thing. And you know, she was actually doing the right thing by charging them, but I think that it, you know, should have taken a different turn. I also believe that it would have taken a whole different tone had this young man been a white man who had been, you know, treated this way, that, you know, people would have been looking at it differently, like, okay, wait a minute, why were you guys even arresting him? He didn't even do anything wrong. That would have been, you know, the conversation that would have been lit, everything would have led with that. Why were you even arresting him? Why was he even being put into the van, you know?
Yeah. Thanks. I appreciate that call. And let me just read this tweet that came in and let you all comment. Mm-hmm. Dan tweeted in respectfully to Doug, he should be clarifying that the state's attorney's office does not think and has no evidence that Frederick Gray was injured during the arrest. And that's also very clear. I mean, that's been brought on the show many times that the state's attorney, obviously, there was, for whatever reason, there is no evidence that he was hurt before he got into the van.
That's a good point, though, Mark, because
Go ahead, but make it. I want to get back over
here. Yeah, the good point is, and I've said this on Sean Yosh's show also, that people are saying that they witnessed things that happened. Now, evidence has to come into the courtroom. So anyone who witnessed something, I'm just holding myself out. You can contact me at the law school, and we can have that private, confidential conversation. Because if there are witnesses that saw what happened to Freddie Gray before he was taken to the van, that's really important for the prosecution.
But there were those witnesses. They were all over the place.
Yes, there were.
They were everywhere. Yeah. They were all around him at the moment.
Yeah.
Either Mosby's office did not question them and ask what they saw.
Or that they have been intimidated as a result of other contacts with the police.
I didn't get the sense that folks in the community, though, Dominic, were intimidated by this. I mean, they were...
No, I didn't. I got the sense that people were not called upon because there are people that we could point you to who certainly said,
Please do.
Right, because, I mean, when Frederick Gray was arrested, there were lots of people around. You heard people yelling in the background, don't you see that boy's leg, et cetera, right?
And some of those folks were, interestingly, they were interviewed by the media, so they showed up in the media as having been witnesses.
One of the persons, of course, as you know, caught it on his cam.
Right.
And then some of the things I've read is he's gotten some harassment since then. That's it.
But he's continued. I mean, he's
anyway.
Set up a cop watch there in the neighborhood. His name is Kevin. As a matter of fact, folks call him Cop Watch Kevin. So, I mean, he's
right.
around, you know. Yeah.
The other thing I would just say about the caller, about the centerpiece being the rough ride, it's really important not just I know people getting their information from the papers or wherever, but in the courtroom, the prosecutor based their case on everything that the defendant Goodson did not do, including taking him to a hospital, calling for a medic, seatbelting him, doing all of those things. The way it gets reported sometimes is that the rough raid was the big item here. It was just one of several pieces of evidence.
Let me get a quick call in here at 410-319-8888. Lala, you're on the air. Lala, good morning. You're on the air.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you very much for taking my call, and thank you
my
for
pleasure.
The show. It's really superb. I agree with the last two callers, too. I'm very distraught that the life of this young man was taken when he was in police custody. The comment I want to make has to do with law and policy, and I want to agree that the law and the policy don't serve the interests of the community. But I also want to point out that the officers have an individual responsibility. They take an oath to serve and protect, and it's not to serve and protect the commissioner or the union or the system, but it's to serve and protect the community, and they need to step up to that. What happened there was wrong. They all know it. They treated somebody with a lot less dignity than that person deserved, not to mention they hurt him, and that's not right. They know that. We need to hold our officers to their own individual responsibility. And I'm a lawyer, and I'm also in the Navy. I take an oath to serve and protect as well. And sometimes that makes me not very popular, and I don't care. I'm sorry, I'm very distraught
that we're still having these conversations in 2016 about the worth of individual life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I deeply appreciate your emotion and your intellect, the way you approach it. I think that that's – I think what Lila and Nicole called earlier, before we go to the next caller, I think, Dominique, is really the sentiment of tens of thousands of people who are deeply aware of this and more, that people are really upset that here a young man was dead and nothing – no justice. Whatever we mean by justice, it's not happening.
I think, I mean, overall, the treatment of Freddie Gray, the treatment of young people of African descent, period, of old people of African descent, of children, you know, that part sticks with me from the first caller, CJ, just affirming, you know, Freddie Gray's humanity. We shouldn't even have to do that. You know what I'm saying? But we constantly have to do that. I remember when the movie about Oscar Grant came out, people talked about it humanized him. It shouldn't have had to humanize him. He was human, you know, and that's what angers me a lot, is the need for us to have to humanize ourselves. We are humans, okay? And that's the really hurtful part about this. And we can talk about the law till we're blue in the face. The reality is, a good number of white folks live above the law and black folks live below the law. Okay. And that's, to me, that's how it plays out in the community. And so the expectation is, of course, going to be low. There was no, I didn't expect that these folks were going to serve any time. I didn't expect that they were going to be found guilty. I really didn't. I've seen it, you know, for years in Baltimore at this point. I've seen, you know, actually no indictments. Even the fact that they were indicted didn't excite me, because it doesn't bring Freddie Gray back, and it does not stop the systematic brutalization of our community.
Let me go back to phones. We'll come back to other guests at 410-319-8888. Michael, in your car, you're on the air.
Hey, good afternoon, or actually good morning,
good
guys.
Morning.
How are you today?
Good morning.
Hey, listen, my sentiment is I'm an African-American male. I've had my scrapes with the law here and there, but I really feel like it's so pessimistic that Ms. Mosby didn't really have an intent to bring the best evidence to the forefront to really get a prosecution. I believe that she's pretty much still on the team either way, and that it was no way for us to get a fair trial for that gentleman. You know, watching the video and seeing this young man not even being able to get into the car on his own will, basically being hauled and pulled and dropped into the van, you know, why wasn't that brought up? Or why wasn't there more concentration on the fact that he was screaming and whimpering prior to being put into the van?
Michael, I appreciate that call. And I think that and let me guess, it has to be a quick comment because we're near the top of the hour.
No, I just would like to push back a bit, because when the caller says, why hasn't the prosecution done something, my response would be, why haven't people come forward to assist the prosecution in doing something? So you have a prosecutor who's putting...
Why hasn't a prosecution... Why didn't the state attorney's office go out to Gilmore Street and find the people to come in and say, this is what we saw?
Okay, so what you have here is you have a police department which is working against the prosecution.
That we know.
You have a police union which is telling its people, and we saw this play out in the courtroom, to be doing things to undermine the prosecution. So if police go out first, let's assume police went out first and basically put the word out that if anyone comes forward and you're on probation or parole, that we are going to, you know, make sure that that's...
But the state's attorney has their own investigators who they could send out.
Well, Mark, all I will say is that this is a situation where the prosecutor's investigators, and I don't know how many the staff is, but I do know how many police officers there are. I do know that that's whom the community is familiar with, because that's who they live with on a 24/7 basis.
But too many people have stated that they were never asked. And so, like, okay, well, I'm not going to assume anything good about the police at this point, but I'm also not going to make that assumption alone as to why people haven't, and this is in quotations, come forward. I think people have. I think that it was incumbent upon Mosby's office to go down to the hood, go down to the community and talk to people. I think that there were plenty of people, and it was visible even from the media, from the young woman saying, y'all going to kill that boy, or whatever she was saying, to, you know, a woman that I see pretty much on a daily basis who talked to CNN. I mean, all they had to do was look at the people the media were interviewing to know that there were people who witnessed it.
Well, I'm saying that there are still three more trials, and there's a trial on July 5th against Lieutenant Rice.
One.
And my hope is that there will be one, but there's still an opportunity for people to come forward and to tell what happened when Lieutenant Rice initiated this entire event.
So there's a Judy tweeted in, my in-laws were cops. They would also be angry over this insanity. Dan tweeted in, the medical examiner and every expert in the case said no, that the nature of injury, not one that results from the human hand. And that is what the medical examiner said. But Dwight Pettit on this program, I'm only pointing to you because that's where Dwight usually sits. Dwight Pettit said on this program that he's always questioned why there was an alternative medical examiner called in to do the investigation beyond the city's medical examiner. To see if there's another finding on where Freddie Gray was actually injured. I mean that and did that van ride exacerbate the injury he received on the street before I get in, and the police and the prosecutors here earlier said, well, no, the police and the prosecutor said that they think Freddie Gray was faking it to go to the hospital instead of going to jail. I mean, so that's – I'm just throwing that out.
Makes sense.
So Dr. Allen did testify, though, Mark, that the injury occurred between stops 2 and 4, and they occurred because – Freddie Gray was slammed into the metal van, or that's how he sustained the injury.
We have to go to an NPR news break, but I would ask you all if you could stay just 5 more minutes, some closing thoughts from the three of you, and then we'll come to our next guest, Larry Jackson, who's written an incredible piece about what's happening here. He's from Baltimore and a really strong observer. We're going to hear from him. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Mark Steiner here with Dominique Stevenson, Dr. Robert Burt, and Doug Colbert. And we're going to get some final thoughts here before we bring Larry Jackson in the room because I want to make sure we had a chance to wrap up. And thinking about what these cases say to us and where they take us and what you think where we go from here. And let me go to Dominique, Robert, Doug.
Okay. You know my story. They've been saying it for 500 years. Ain't nothing changed.
And I know this and Dominique is a woman whose ancestors whispered to her all the time.
All the time.
I know that's right.
Basically,
close to the mic, Robert.
Oops. Sorry. Basically, it means that the community itself have to think about how to organize its own defense, and we have to think about creating alternative institutions. I commend Brother Kevin, the cop watch brother. We have to think about things of that kind. And ultimately, we're also going to have to talk about, and this is beyond, I guess, the range of this particular program, we have to talk about also just the fundamental role of the police in society and what kind of society it is that has to have this kind of police. And we've got to think about how to organize ourselves. You do whatever you can with the legal system, whatever you want to do, but don't make that what you primarily rely upon. Don't make the courts and police reformers what you primarily rely on. You've got to think about in terms of the organizing, the politics of struggle, the politics of liberation. You have to organize your defense.
Yeah, and I certainly agree with the role of police through community organizing. I mean, if community's voice is not part of what's taking place, then the police have no idea what community expects from them. When I see public officials, though, you know, putting themselves on the line and doing things that are not normally done, I think it's really important to try to support those attacks on public officials who are trying to do something that would give voice and protection to the Freddie Grays in our community and to all the other people who wind up in the justice system. And that's where I see them. I see them in jail without being able to pay bail. They shouldn't be there. They lose jobs. Their families are hurting. And that's where it comes back to community again.
So there's a lot here, and we'll continue this conversation. I mean, I think we're going to really kind of push conversations here on the show about alternative ways of public safety and more in this city. And I think there are a lot of ideas, and we're going to put those on the table and force our politicians to wrestle with them as well with us. On the way to break here, we're bringing Larry Jackson. I'll remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank, belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or steinershow.org is MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner. We'll be right back.